Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Pop Culture Uncovered. I thought instead of my typical pithy, smart aleck, you know, opening, I thought we would do something different. So I'm going to say, can you guess what we're going to talk about tonight? And so I'm going to read a little bit of dialogue for you, see if you can guess it. I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over and through me. That's right, we talking about Doom, baby. Is that time? May that blade chip and shatter. It's time. We have waited patiently for Doom Part 2. No, we're not talking about Doom Part 2 just yet, because we have our press passes. So we will definitely be bringing you a rapid fire response to Doom Part 2, also known as Zendaya Kills. But in the interim, we're going to talk about 1984 Doom by David Lynch versus Doom Part 1. Now, I will just say this. I just went and saw Doom Part 1 in IMAX because I consciously decided that having saw how beautiful it was looking at it on HBO Max, that I didn't want to actually watch it on streaming first. I wanted to see it on a big screen. And the thing that I was stunned by was I expected that I would love Doom Part 1 for being a more faithful adaptation of the book, which holds up pretty well for a 1956 science fiction book, I must say. Just read it over Christmas. But I walked away saying, I love both of these movies. And I love both of these movies for very different reasons. Though respective directors and casts make very different decisions. The visuals are very different. And there are benefits to one vision and there are benefits to another. So it's funny, more than anything else, I walked away with a profound appreciation for the creatives that are involved in bringing these worlds to life. Because you can see everybody's conscious choices and how that shaped everything. But having said all that, I've been talking so long, you might think I was a mentat. So let me go ahead and introduce our resident Bene Gesserit, Belle. Belle, how's it going?
I am awake.
You're awake. You don't have a pain box with you, do you?
I didn't say that.
Okay, you don't have a Gum Jabbar with you, do you?
I didn't say that either.
Okay, and now we're moving on from Belle, and we're going over to Pete, who is our resident Gurney. So, hey, Gurney.
Oh, man. This is going to be good. I'm excited. You're right. Just right off the bat, I will say I have so much love for both of these movies, and although I feel like with Dune Part 1, it was almost... I had such high expectations that it was never going to meet them. And so I'm sort of at this place where I'm like starting to level off with, you know, the expectations versus what we got. And ultimately I'm still excited for Part 2.
No, I'm right there with you. I mean, I think there's a massive amount of storytelling potential with 2, because I feel like some of the decisions I feel like that are coming, it's not just adapting the movie, it's kind of updating it a little bit. And I think that gives it... If you're a fan of the book, you can be a fan of the book. You can be a fan of the movies. And I think you can approach it lots of different ways. I should say, in the midst of all this, there was also a really great sci-fi channel, Dune and Children of Dune miniseries that came out years ago that I have on Blu-ray as well. Now, granted, William Hurt as Duke Leto was not the world's greatest casting choice. But beyond that, that was one of James McAvoy's earliest appearances. He played Paul's son, Leto II, and did a marvelous job doing it. So there's a lot of fantastic Dune to watch. But I guess first things first, let's talk about 84 for a second before we jump over to Dune Part 1. Which I should say, some of this, we have to give kind of a kiss to Jaworski's Dune, which is a great documentary if you haven't watched it. It's a great way of understanding what the efforts to bring Dune to the screen actually did for sci-fi. When you hear names like Dan O'Bannon, H.R. Giger, these are all people that were tapped by Jaworski to do the original Dune, and were just unable to get American funding, in part because he was such an avant-garde kind of unique director. But Dune 84 was I think David Lynch's last real big commercial big budget film. It's literally the thing that kind of pulled him away from it. If you are at all anywhere near as enamored as I am with Dune 84, I will make a recommendation before I go any further. You should check out a book called A Masterpiece in Disarray by Max Every, which is literally, they went back and interviewed everybody from the cast of 84 to talk about the process, everything that happened. But seeing how, you know, we were all kids when Dune 84 came out, Pete, I'll just ask you the following question. What was your reaction to Dune the first time you can remember seeing it?
I, of course, since I was so young when it came out, you know, I think it's like around 8 or something. It was one of those movies that didn't pop up in my life until it was, you know, Saturday afternoons, 2 o'clock, Dune would be on, and it would just be on forever. And there were a handful of movies like that, that like I saw in bits and pieces as I was running in and out of the house. I think of like the film Explorers that way, similarly, in that it was just kind of always on. And so it was really a long time before I even sat and watched all the way through. I just remember it feeling like both the book that sat on like my parents' bookshelf, you know, in that weird, like intimidating, like you can't handle this book right now kind of way. Like this isn't for you. It also felt a little bit that way with the movie. Like I struggled as a kid to, you know, to me, sci-fi movies were, you know, shoot 'em ups and, you know, spaceships and, you know, heroes and princesses and stuff. Or, you know, like Flight of the Navigator. It was these were the movies that were sci-fi to me as a kid. And so Dune just felt like as daunting to watch as reading the books seemed when I was, you know, between 8 and probably 15. And then the first time I watched it, probably in my late teens, I was like, oh, this is one of those movies that like I'm going to be thinking about for a lot longer when I'm older. Like I started to sort of recognize that. And just the fact that, you know, the body of David Lynch's work, you know, after Dune is so well known and is something that like my generation definitely connected to, Twin Peaks in particular. It's still weird. That movie is still weird. And to me, and it's still like, gives me that same feeling where I'm like, I feel like I don't even know what I'm watching right now. Every single time I'm like, this thing it's not just that it made no sense. It's that it was just so ahead of its time. You could see where the technology was failing the ideas. You could see where like, you know, you could see where the budget was there, but it wasn't nearly ever, it was never going to be enough to convey the world, particularly as Lynch was seeing it, you know, through his own eyes. And so it's at best just this sort of half version of whatever was going on inside his brain and whatever the plot of the books actually was. And so it will just always be weird to me. It'll always be a little bit unapproachable, unreachable. And that's kind of just been the excitement of that movie for most of my life.
Belle, I know you are like a hard sci-fi classic person. I mean, I know I think you've read all 6 of Frank Herbert's books. I think you've read some of Brian Herbert's Dune stuff as well. So I mean, you come to Dune extraordinarily well versed in the universe and the lore and everything. So I guess if I could ask you to drop for a second the monumental amount of knowledge that you have on this topic, and if you kind of time travel back to when you first saw it, what were your initial reactions the first time you saw Dune 84?
I was terrified of the Spicing Guild. I remember seeing that movie. I was maybe 7 or 8. And my mom took me to see that movie. And that thing, when that moment when it opens up and it goes back and that thing coming out was the scariest thing I had ever seen. And that one moment made such a vast impression on me as a kid. One of the things I remember thinking was, this is genuinely the scariest thing I'd seen ever. But also, even as a kid, because I'd grown up reading classical literature, even as at a young age, I think my brain was making connections even that young that I wasn't quite ready to understand. Like to your point, Pete, about it being a book. That book, the Dune books, the Iliad, the Epic of Gilgamesh, those were things that were just in my house that we were supposed to read. We were expected to read. in our house. And so I hadn't read the book yet, but my mom wanted me to read it, so she took me to see the film. And I was making the connections between the Greek basis of it all. One of the things that I remember, as soon as I heard the name Leto Atreides, I was like, oh, they're doomed. Just because of the classical connections to with that name specifically, Leto, and how, you know, the goddess Leto doesn't have a great time. And so I was young enough, I didn't understand fully what was happening on screen, but I do remember being enthralled by it. I remember being terrified of the Gom Jabbar. I remember trying to figure out, would I be able to pass the test if it were me? Would I be able to, even though my brain is registering pain and torment, would I be able to let it go and let it pass through me? I also remember being fascinated by the culture of the Fremen, not knowing, as I do now, how much it pulled from Middle Eastern culture, and being utterly fat, but I did it did remind me of nomadic tribes from West Africa and Native American tribes. And it reminded me a great deal of that. And my mom and I had, we would have, my mom was always keen to have discussions after a film about things and things that I made connections to. And, you know, she would give me references and then go, well, let's look it up and see, you know, let's see what it means. So I, the movie, I appreciated the movie even as a child because A, it, my mom and I spent a lot of time together dissecting it. And B, because of that, it, I started looking into other cultures in a way that I probably would not have. Because the movie, the books, and the films draw a great deal from multiple cultures. Growing up, the Dune series, I it sent me down a rabbit hole of learning. And so I really appreciated that. I also thought the score was a banger. Toto showed up and showed out, and I appreciated that about them. That actually was what made me go back and, like, as a kid, go, who's this band? And try to find out more about them because I had no idea who Toto was. And then I started to go and look into their other music and fell in love with them as a band. So it was a Dune to me was an eye-opener in terms of what sci-fi could do. It should have been a longer movie, or it should have been broken up. That wasn't a thing that was done yet, but I kept thinking this probably should have either been longer or shorter and in two parts. So I actually really respect that they did make it a two-part film with the most recent version.
No, I was like, I'll just say quickly, my first reaction in seeing Dune was the fact that I loved how philosophically I couldn't be a Jedi, right? No matter how much thinking of moving rocks, I wasn't going to be move rocks with my mind, pick up a lightsaber. But I loved the pain box and the Gon Jabbar and the philosophy of it in terms of Dune was much more grounded. So for me, Dune was kind of like Blade Runner in terms of like this is the future. I could see myself having to live in this world trying to navigate all of these things. And I think that's one of the things that made Dune interesting to me in a way, and gave it a longevity. Because in fact, it's really only one for a long time we only had one movie. I mean, we went from 84. I don't think the Dune miniseries on Sci-Fi Channel comes out until the early 2000s.
Yeah,
So
so 2000.
yeah, so I mean, like Dune, I mean, for just one movie, it kept and held my imagination for a long time, which was impressive for it to having been only been one film. Having said that, I want to jump into talking about the casting for both movies for a second, because one, I feel like they're very much of their own time periods, but it's also there are some very interesting creative choices that are being made. So first things first, Paul, 1984 Dune, we get Kyle MacLachlan. Which is a much older, much more seasoned, much more believable Paul in terms of like the, oh, if Leto gets killed, Paul gonna step right in. Like, you know, and which is ironic considering the fact that was Kyle MacLachlan's first film. He was coming from the world of theater, and then he plays Paul Atreides, which is a hell of a jump. So shows you got to have real skill to make it out there as an actor. Like, you can't just growl and spit, like, go from Shakespeare. Oh yeah, we'll have you play maybe one of the most iconic characters of all time. Don't screw it up. And versus Timothée Chalamet, where we've got a younger Paul that's emotionally available in ways that Kyle MacLachlan's Paul is very closed off. Like, one of the big aspects of Paul as a character is his love affair with Chani, because he's literally dreaming about her long before he meets her. Kyle MacLachlan Paul, it's kind of hard to believe that he ever falls in love with Chani, because it's kind of just like, you know, we have like a quick cut scene as we're like, you know, over the course of the next 6, you know, the last, you know, 6 months, the Fremen have been blowing up stuff and Paul fell in love with Chani and it's all great. Where with Timothée Chalamet, there's a longing for her, because you can see in the life that he's living, there's nothing like her in that life. And so it makes it more believable. And I thought that casting choice, I mean, we don't have time to go character by character, but I did want to talk about Paul for a second. What did you guys think about that juxtaposition in terms of the differences between the two Pauls? Pete, go ahead.
I felt with Timothée Chalamet, I feel Paul's uncertainty. I feel Paul's youth. It's funny, the actors are almost the same exact age, both 25. Kyle MacLachlan, though, has never looked 25. He looked 50 in that movie. He still looks 50. So it's great. Like, some actors, you know, hit an age. So it's strange to see just the differences, even though these are two men, you know, who are the same age. There is an uncertainty. There is a youthfulness. There is a, you know, that's almost deceptive, because this story isn't that coming of age, you know, learning about yourself kind of story that we have come to expect from, you know, from sort of cookie cutter sci-fi. This is Dune. Dune did it different before, you know, before in many of the things that came after it, that became sci-fi tropes. Dune as a story precedes them, which is always what makes it so funny to see modern adaptations. So there's something about that, like, growth. There's something about, you know, I never loved Kyle MacLachlan's, you know, narration in it, or like, that was one way to convey like what he was thinking, but it turns out we didn't really need that, because, you know, with the direction in these current movies, you still get that. You still get that first person perspective, but you also get the mystery of figuring things out as he's figuring them out, where we don't, you know, need that 80s convention of listening to Kyle MacLachlan's narration. It totally took me out.
For the record, I don't want you to lose your train of thought, but you're literally channeling for me. I'm remembering like the Harrison Ford being aggravated about having to do the voiceover for Blade
Yes,
Runner, and
it's so '80s.
he was like, this is so stupid. He's like, nah, I'm a detective that doesn't detect anything.
Right.
But go ahead.
No, but that's pretty much it. I enjoyed both performances. You know, the 84 Dune is just cemented in my brain. And so everything is very interesting about the new Dune, because it is new. But both actors bring something very unique to the characters, that is, you know, that helps set these movies so far apart from one another, even though there are moments where, like, oh, this is the exact scene I've been waiting to see. And somehow, even when it is visually very similar, even when it's tonally very similar, and it's like, you know, being told almost exactly as written, it's still so different from movie to movie. And that's, I've enjoyed that.
Okay, so Belle.
One of the things, Chalamet is very different from McLaughlin's Paul, but there are threads that are the same. His youthful arrogance and assuming that he knows way more than he knows. His power and not knowing what to do with it, his fear of the abilities that he has, those threads are played well by both actors. What is interesting for me is having read all of the books, having read the prequels as well as the main 6 books, is Chalamet, even though he is the same exact age as McLaughlin was when he was cast to Peter Point. He looks infinitely younger. And that speaks to what Herbert was writing about, which is literally not but a century ago, at the age of 13, in most cultures, you were considered at your majority. You were trained almost, especially if you were expected to inherit land or property. So, with McLaughlin's fault, you see that more. You see that he has been trained pretty much since he was knee-high to a grasshopper, even beyond the fact that Leto is training him to take over, just like Leto was. If you guys read House Atreides, Leto was also sent away. Leto was sent away at, I want to say, 14 to Ix to learn their culture, which is something that in the books explores more, which is all the major houses sent their eldest children to the other houses. It was both a learning experience, but also a hostage situation, right? So Paul, in some ways, is far more protected than Leto was. And with Chalamet's, you see the protection. Paul wasn't sent away the way he should have been sooner, far sooner than the events of the film, both films happened. Paul should have been gone. He should have never been on Arrakis, because he should have been sent to another house by that point. And that speaks to Jessica and Leto's love for each other and their love for their child, who was not just a political pawn, like all of the other children of the Landsred. So with McLaughlin's Paul, you see that training, you see that military training that has been drilled into him pretty much since birth, combined with the Bene Gesserit training that not other kids in the Landsred would have received. So you see that with Chalamet's Paul, you see the training, but you also see the youth, the innocence, in a way that McLaughlin's character doesn't have. McLaughlin's version of Paul doesn't seem to have that level of innocence that Chalamet's does. Go ahead, Amar.
I agree with you. I don't want you to lose your train of thought. What you made me think of was the inclusion of Jamis in Dune Part One, where he's missing in Dune 84, because it speaks to a great principle that you raised in terms of his innocence. Paul's trying to come up with every conceivable way to get Jamis to stop trying to fight him so he doesn't kill him. The Fremen are getting aggravated because they're like, why is he playing with him? Until Jessica's like, he's not playing with him. He's never killed anybody before. And what I loved about that was this really is a boy having to become something that he never wanted to be. And I felt like that was handled. I don't think it's a difference in actors. It's a difference in artistic direction and dialogue. So the biggest thing for me tonight, as we're kind of comparing and contrasting the cast, it's really important for me to say the following. You can't cast any aspersions on either group because the differences in dialogue, in some cases, with the exception of one character, that would be Gurney. For every other character, the dialogue choices can be so different, and it so catastrophically changes the relationship, as to which my overarching argument, or my thesis statement for this podcast is, you have to love both films separately because they're so damn different. I want to keep the conversation going. I want to talk. Go ahead, just jump into some of the differences in the film, because the casting kind of plays all into all that. And the first character I want to talk about is Duncan. So one, let me say this. I loved Richard Jordan. Richard Jordan was an actor that I grew up with. He was Jack Ryan's boss in Hunt for Red October. I had seen him in a bunch of movies. A chronically underutilized character in the first Dune movie. I mean,
Oh, absolutely. It's infuriating, actually, especially if you know
the
exactly
story.
how important Duncan's going to be to the overall story.
And I felt that the failure to use Duncan effectively took a lot away from the story, because as I was kind of explaining Dune to my wife, one of the things I was telling her, I was like, one of the things that makes Dune unique, it's one of the only movies I can think of where the male character, it's realistic. Men trying to figure out who you're going to be as a man, you're copying from every man that you know that you respect who's an adult, trying to cobble together, well, who am I going to be when I grow up? And so for the casting for Dune Part One, like the relationships with Thufir and Duncan and Gurney, it makes sense why Paul is like, I'm trying to replicate something from each man. And I think the beauty of Duncan with Jason Momoa, which I was like, I was worried. I was like, I know he's got the acting chops. I'm not worried about that. I'm worried if they're going to give him the writing. And God, did they give that man dialogue that was equivalent to his ability? Bell, I know Duncan is a heart is held close to your heart. So I will turn it over to you. What did you think about how Duncan was used in Dune Part One as opposed to Dune 84?
So, in Dune Part One, Duncan is everything he should be. You see the character who, at the age of, I want to say, 7, outwitted Raban, which is why Raban has a hard on for him specifically in the films to kill him specifically out of everybody in House Atreides is Duncan he wants. That's why. Because Duncan, at the age of 7, figured out how to beat that man. And we see that in Momoa's Duncan. We see that fierceness, but we also see that he didn't lose his compassion in the character. The way he interacts with Paul is everything I wanted to see in 1984. Looking back on it, I rewatched the films today since I knew we were going to talk about it. I didn't get rewatched Dune Part One, but I did rewatch 1984. And you see, Richard Jordan again gives the most that he can do with the dialogue that he has. But, and you can see the warmth, but that almost brotherly relationship that they have, which is super important to what goes on in the next 5 books. That relationship, the relationship between Duncan and Paul is so integral to everything that goes. I can't spoil it for people who've never read them, but it is so important to everything that happens going forward from that point on. And so to see every moment of that and the love that those two characters have for each other and how they are basically brothers in all but name, was so wonderful to see in Dune Part One. And Momoa and Chalamet together are just gold. They really are. The two of them, I would have never thought. Kudos to the casting director because I would have never thought that those two together would be so great together. But I believe them. I believe that they adore each other and that they would die for each other. And that is super important because that relationship is foundational to the entire series. So that's the first thing. I think that we lose Richard Jordan's, we don't even see him again in 1984.
We see him twice. We see him
We
for we
Yeah, we
see
see him in the
twice.
very beginning.
We see him twice. We see him once when he basically his job is basically to tell Paul your father's looking for you. That's
Yeah. And
one.
then we see him
Two.
battling the
When,
fight.
for the briefest of moments.
Yeah.
And I want to say this before I kick it back to you. My thing was if you had read the books, you could not understand the Duncan from 1984 dying the way that he did as quickly as he did. Dune Part One, you're like, yeah, he's the sword master for House Atreides. He's the guy that's so good. Gurney, who's also awesome, is the backup replacement because Duncan's not available to train Paul because Duncan's gone off on a secret mission. So Jason Momoa, but Bell, I agree with you in terms of the relationship. And I'll say this, the reason why it matters is I think if you're a guy and if you've ever been fortunate enough to have a really great mentor, you can see there's an understanding between an older man and a younger man where nothing needs to be said. I, without spoiling anything for anybody, because you should watch Dune Part One before you see Part Two, Duncan's way of saying I love you and goodbye is so pitch perfect and so heartbreaking that it reminds you the difference between for me between Dune and Star Wars is that Dune is playing on the tragedies of life. You will lose people who are irreplaceable, and you will be scarred from having lost them. They won't be magical voices that come back to you from the void. They're just gone, and you're just left to deal with it. And I felt like, look, if Jason Momoa could possibly be any more of a star than he already is, I'm kind of like, his performance in Dune, I'm kind of like, if James Gunn makes him Lobo, I'm not going to hurt anybody, but I'm gonna throw marshmallows really fiercely at somebody.
I wish that 1984 had allowed, because Richard Jordan is such a great actor as well, to allow him to have that space. But that goes to my original point, which is the movie, they tried to cram a book that is the same thickness as the first Lord of the Rings book into one film. And you can't, there's so much, and with that specific relationship, it's too much to try to condense. So those two, yeah, it was just, I really liked the casting for both films. I'm glad that we got to see what Duncan was about more in this one. Pete, what were you going to say?
Just that there's a mischievousness to Jason Momoa, right? Like, there's always that angle of him, and I think it plays really well in that movie, in giving it a kind of a big brother kind of feel to that character, that places them, at least that relationship places them closer, where, you know, between the age and sort of the acting that was happening, you know, in the 1984 version, is we didn't have that kind of closeness necessarily. And, you know, each, there's, I think, benefits to that as much as there are, you know, negatives. But I just really like this relationship, and I like, you know, being able to see what's going on.
This is so sad and depressing. I have so much fun talking with you. It sucks that we have to stop things here because, of course, we're combining like two gigantic like movies together. It's like a supersized meal. So as a consequence, we're going to have to pause our conversation for now. But there is a part two where we will clear up all of the wonderful differences between Dune Part 1 and Dune 84. So if you've enjoyed this conversation, the conversation is going to keep going. So definitely check us out next episode where we touch on that. Beyond that, in the interim, may thy blade not shatter. May you live forever. And may you always have the water of life ready and available. And we'll check you out on part two.
We all know Belle's going to live forever.
I mean, was that ever like a debatable issue? Right. Belle's going to be like the new Duncan. She's going to get cloned. It'll be 5,000 years after the events of the original film. None of us will be around. And Bill will be like, I remember there was this guy named Armand once. He was annoying and he had no hair.
Belle, Idaho.
Wow.
Oh, okay. God, I'm not forgetting that. I am not forgetting that. Okay, for Belle and for Pete, this is Armand. We will catch you next time. This is why you can't mess with Belle, because the sleeper must awaken. Belle always awakens. That's the damn problem.